Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
This morning I'll be reading from Exodus 2, 1 through 10. Exodus 2, 1 through 10. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and dabbed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young woman walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take the child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water."
As we begin a new month together, we're going to be thinking of a specific verse from Joshua to help us focus our minds on what it means to live faithfully. And so if you would, let's say this together. Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Joshua 1:9. One of the reasons that passage is so fitting is because we're moving into a new series, or rather a new chapter in our series of messages all year long, in that Hebrews Hall of Faith, Hebrews chapter 11. We've come to the end of Genesis, and now we're starting on specifically the story of Moses, but in a larger sense, the story of God's people. And this idea of God being with them wherever they go is going to be incredibly important. Now, I don't know if you have the kind of personality where you always like to have a plan. That's kind of the way I like to think. I like to have a plan. I want a plan for every kind of eventuality. I want to know if I'm facing a challenge, what my plan's going to be, how are we going to get through it. That makes me feel better if there's something that's happened that's tough to deal with. Let's make a plan. Let's sit down and plan it out. Maybe you're not a plan kind of person, but I like that. And some plans are better than others. I was talking with my dad a few days ago, and he told me about a couple in their congregation. Both are in their late 80s, and they're neighbors with another younger couple in the congregation. They've gotten to be good friends. And so one morning, as this young lady that's their neighbor was sitting down for some coffee at her kitchen table, she looked through her window and saw this woman, her friend, in her late 80s, standing on the roof ledge on her second story so that she could paint one of the shutters of the window on her second story. And so it was one of those houses where there's a little bit of a ledge of a roof before you have that first story, and she's standing there painting the shutters. And so they were a little concerned. And so this woman called her husband over, and he walked over to the house and asked what was going on. And she said not to worry, because as she was standing there on one floor off the ground, she had a rope tied around her waist. And on the other end of the rope, sitting in a chair in that room, was her husband, also in his late 80s. She had it all planned out. If anything happened, and you might want to take a step back and say, I don't know if that was the greatest plan or not, but they had it planned out. And she got the window painted and was very happy with the way it looked. And so it all worked out together. Some plans are better than others. And it's interesting to see that in Scripture, there are times in which God has plans that seem pretty outlandish to the average bystander. You would say, how is that going to work? How is that going to happen? And as we begin thinking about the life of Moses, God's plan for delivering his people out of slavery begins with a life-changing birth. Now, does that sound a little familiar? There are so many parallels between the life of Jesus and the life of Moses, but one of those is that you have a people that absolutely needs freedom from slavery, and the way in which God chooses to accomplish that is through something that seems unassuming, normal, maybe even mundane. You have the birth of a child. Now, we know that would have been normal because we know that the Israelites were having a lot of children. When we left Joseph at the end of Genesis, he had brought his entire family over to Egypt. And one of the things that happens in those later chapters is he warns his family. He says that Egyptians don't look highly upon shepherds. So describe yourselves as keepers of livestock, not as shepherds. But when they go before Pharaoh, they do describe themselves as shepherds. And even though they live in a nice territory, in the land of Goshen, an area that was very nice, they are in an occupation that was not looked very highly upon by the Egyptians. And so then as we begin reading, if you're in Exodus 2, that Tyler just read for us, if we back up a little bit to Exodus chapter 1, I want us to read just a few verses to give us some context about what happens. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household. Remember these brothers we talked about, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now look at verse 8. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply. And in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And notice the action that Pharaoh takes. The king of Egypt in verse 15 spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah and the other was named Puah. And he said, "When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and to see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So let's pause for just a moment and think about the context into which Moses was born. You have a Pharaoh that comes to power that doesn't know Joseph. Now, I guess when I first remember reading that, I remember thinking of a Pharaoh that comes to power and he doesn't know who Joseph is or who his family is. And that can happen. History can move pretty rapidly, and all of a sudden, people that were once familiar a few years later are not as familiar. I think I've shared before the story of my high school chorus teacher. He was the choral conductor for years at Harding Academy, Jim Chester, for over 30 years. If you went to Harding, you knew Mr. Chester, and you knew who he was, and that he led the chorus. And he was a director who had so many people come through his choruses. And in his retirement years, he started driving the bus for field trips. And so he drove the bus for an elementary field trip. These are students that hadn't been to the high school. They didn't know who he was. But he was driving them, and it was in December. So he started singing some of those Christmas carols that kids love, you know, Frosty the Snowman, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, those kinds of things. And he was leading them, and they were having a good time doing all the different parts. And when they got off the bus, one of the second graders looked at his teacher and said, "That guy's a pretty good singer for a bus driver," and then walked into the field trip. Well, if he had known, he would have known. He's a choral director, but he didn't know. He didn't know that situation. But it also could mean something a little more nuanced than that. Because the terminology here for know goes beyond just being able to recognize someone or to know who they are. It might be a little more along the lines of knowing and being closely acquainted with and appreciating. The previous Pharaoh had known and appreciated what Joseph did. He had lived through the times when there was a famine, and Joseph was the one who provided an answer. But you know, our appreciation for things in the past can dissolve pretty quickly. And so it seems that this Pharaoh doesn't have that same level of appreciation for Joseph and his family. What he sees instead is a threat. And Egypt was constantly battling with enemies that were without. On the west, they had sort of a desert area, but in the east, they had a lot of people that they were battling with. And he starts thinking, you know, if we go into battle and they start turning these Hebrews against us, then we're going to be in big trouble. And so he starts doing something that also parallels the life of Jesus. He decides to find a way to eliminate these children that are increasingly being born. And as chapter 1 tells us, even though he tries to include the midwives in on that plan, they refuse to. Now, it's interesting to think about the transition that goes from being a shepherd, shepherding people, maybe not looked on very highly, to now being slaves. They start to make some structures. They start to read about them making bricks. If you want to get a visual image of this, there's a museum on the campus of the University of Chicago, the Oriental Institute Museum, and they've uncovered some bricks. These two specifically, you'll notice, are blue in color. It doesn't mean all of these sorts of bricks were blue, but often when you were laying the foundation of some of these structures, you would have some special stones in the foundation. And so that seems to be what these are. These give us just a little bit of a visual image of Egyptian bricks that would have been constructed. So they might not have been this color, but we think about what they were involved in making. And I think it's important to realize that these are events that, although we have question marks as to exactly what Pharaoh was in power, a lot of the movies we watch choose Ramses, but there are a couple of different options there. We're not sure exactly how every aspect of the timeline fits in, but this is a real event that really happened. In fact, it's interesting to look at some other archaeological discoveries. One is a fresco painting, a relief here, that you can see the imagery of a people, a Semitic people, which seem to be related to the Hebrews, that are in Egypt, and they are involved in leaving Egypt. And so some have looked at that and seen relationship to the Israelites. Or even one of the earliest inscriptions that we have that evidence the existence of Israel, the Merneptah Stela, which is in Egypt. But in this, one of the kings does something that kings often do when they're recording history, talks about all the people that he's defeated. And among that group, he describes Israel. Now, it seems like he might be exaggerating a little bit, because that often happened in these. But he also describes Israel at this time as a nation that doesn't seem to have a home, that doesn't seem to have a land. And that fits in with what we know. I share these things just because it's a good reminder for us when we're thinking about these events that took place, that they are real things that really happened and real lives are involved here. We're looking at real faith from real people. And so when we read through Hebrews chapter 11, we get to this by faith passage. And Moses is linked to this by faith passage in Hebrews 11:23, but it's really the actions of his parents that are praised in that first verse about Moses. Because by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months. We find out a few chapters later, his parents were named Amram and Jochebed. And they take action with this life-changing birth. They react in a way that shows us incredible faith. And there are two specific aspects of their actions that Hebrews highlights in verse 23. Notice, he was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, number one, and they were not afraid of the king's edict, number two. And so if I'm trying to understand how they responded to God's plan, how they reacted to this life-changing birth, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. Number one, the first thing Moses' parents did is they recognized Moses' value. They looked at Moses and they saw something that convinced them he was different. Now, it's interesting when you read this passage because it's hard to get an accurate feeling for everything that's involved in looking at him and seeing he is a fine child, your translation may say, a beautiful child. There's something special about him. Now, I know it's a challenge to understand because I have yet to talk to a parent that didn't look at the face of their baby and say, this is a beautiful child, right? That is a natural parental reaction. And maybe even more so for, you know, grandparents thinking about who's got the best looking grandchild. I mean, we're all convinced that it's our children, it's our grandchildren. So that's a natural thing, and that's a good thing. But it does seem like there's something a little bit more significant here when they look at Moses, that they're able to recognize something. There's something different about him. And they were able to do something else significant, which I just have to tell you, if you wonder whether or not God is at work in these circumstances, they were able to hide him for 3 months. Now, we don't know if they were doing checks of these Israelite families every day. We don't know exactly how they were enforcing this commandment of the king. But as you know, children in the first 3 months make a lot of noise. That's their job. That's what they're doing. They're figuring things out. And so being able to keep this child hidden for 3 months is pretty impressive. But then they get to a point where they realize something has to be done. And so as Tyler read for us, they do something again that shows that they value Moses' life. Because it wasn't uncommon in the ancient world, if you had a child that you did not wish to keep, to put that child out and let he or she be exposed to the elements. As brutal as that sounds. But that's not what happens here. There's a basket that's carefully crafted. You have the same kind of terminology as the ark that Noah built. And he's placed in there. His sister is stationed sort of to keep watch over what happens. And notice when you get to Exodus chapter 2, notice in verse 3, she put the child into the basket and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. It seems to me there's intention here. Now, if you watch some of the movies, even I'm thinking of The Prince of Egypt, which came out a few years ago, but I remember watching that growing up in junior high, and you see this basket, and in that movie, they sort of set it on the river, and it's almost like a rapids ride that you have at Disney World. You know that it goes through here, and then an alligator almost gets it, and a hippo almost gets it, and then a fishing boat almost gets it, and then it ends up, happens to be right in front of Pharaoh's daughter. It seems to me the language indicates that she's setting it in a specific place. And so while it's obviously an exercise of faith, there may have been a plan here. There may have been knowledge over who's going to be in this area. I don't know exactly, but I think it's interesting that you have a specific plan. You have a sister stationed to see what happens. And then Pharaoh's daughter also sees value in the child. She would have known about the edict. She would have known about her father's commandment. But she sees something as well. And God uses these circumstances in such a powerful and a tremendous way. Because notice what Miriam does. When she asks if Pharaoh's daughter needs a Hebrew woman to nurse him, and she says yes, so then she goes and gets his mother. And Pharaoh's daughter pays his mother to take care of her child. God is at work here. They're convinced of Moses' value. So I have to ask myself, if I'm really looking at things in life, and if I'm able to really assess what true value is, do I recognize things that are valuable? You often see shows on TV where someone can go to a flea market or someone can go to an antique store and they can look at something, and because of their prior knowledge, they're able to recognize value. Where I would look at that same thing and say, I don't know if that's valuable or not. I don't know if anybody would buy that. I don't know if anybody would pay money for that. But there's something about people having knowledge about what's valuable that's important. You know, we live in a world that although we might not look at Exodus chapter 2 and say, well, you know, at least we don't live under that kind of edict where you have that sort of inhumane, unthinkable treatment happening. Don't we live in a world where there are laws that allow babies to have their lives taken from them? Don't we live in a world where life is often seen as very cheap and not worth as much? Won't it take courage for us to fight back and to value every single person's life? To value not just the lives of children, but also the lives of other people we meet? And instead of being caught up in a world that wants to divide based on what our experience is, or what our ethnicity is, or what kind of heritage we've grown up with, to be able to look and to realize there is value in every single person I meet, because he or she is a soul that Jesus died to save and created in the image of God, and to make judgments about differences between people and say they're not worth as much as I am is just not something you find in Scripture. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's going to take courage for us to see value in places where people around us might dismiss someone's value. It's going to be a challenge for us to truly know what matters. And not just in the lives of people. It'll be a challenge for us to know what actions, what character traits are valuable. Because there are a lot of traits that God calls us to develop from Scripture that aren't seen as being valued very highly today. That people might not hold honesty and integrity up at the same level as material success. Or they might not hold wisdom and discretion to the same level as coming up with the perfect comeback. Or coming up with the perfect thing to say to put someone in his or her place. And so we're going to have to choose. Are we able to value what's truly valuable? But not only that, Hebrews tells us they were unafraid of the king's edict. They refused to allow the opposition of Pharaoh to cower them to the point of not acting. And I think that's powerful. It's powerful because it shows a courage here, maybe even an expectation that God is at work, that something has happened. There are historically some parallels between the birth of Moses and the birth of Jesus. One of those is the paranoid ruler that's setting out to take the lives of children. But we also see God at work in the very one who is opposing. And think about what the king was afraid of. Pharaoh was afraid of them rising up and leaving the land. And the very one who's opposed to that ends up raising the deliverer in his own household. God is at work here. There's no opposition by any powerful ruler that can overcome God. And it's important to think about Egypt as not just being a small, little, out-of-the-way nation. This was not a pushover country. Egypt was a powerhouse of natural resources, of architectural design. It's no accident that all throughout Genesis, when there's a famine in the land, people go to Egypt. That's what happened with Abraham. That's what happens with Joseph and his family. Egypt had the resources. This was a powerhouse of a nation. But it wasn't more powerful than God was. They were undeterred by any opposition that would have happened. And it's interesting that much like in the life of Joseph, when we look through Joseph's life, we didn't see the specific communication from God that we saw with Abraham or we saw with Jacob, but God was at work. And the same thing happens in these opening chapters of Exodus. We don't see God talking to anyone specifically, but God is in every page. He is at work guiding these circumstances. And maybe it's helpful for us to realize that even though I'm not going to get the direct confirmation from God I might want, maybe it would help me if I could have a direct conversation where God says, yes, this is what's happening. This is what I'm doing behind the scenes. But I can know that God is active. So how do I respond to opposition? How do I react? Am I determined that I'm not going to let any opposition stop me from doing what's right? Am I willing to face people who might disagree with decisions that I make? Am I willing to deal with the aftermath of what it means in my relationships to say, this is what I believe. And I love everyone who disagrees with me, but I believe in this. This is the standard for me. Am I willing to deal with the ramifications of doing business and saying, this is what's right, and I'm only going to do what's right? And if you're not interested in doing what's right, then I really can't do business with you. There are some challenges there. We're going to face some opposition. And so am I willing to recognize what's valuable? Not to be overcome by circumstances, but to realize God will see me through any circumstances. It's interesting to see a Pharaoh described here who doesn't know Joseph. I think we can see some parallels here too in our culture. A culture that maybe we look around and we say, I don't know if I recognize this that's around me anymore. Things have changed a lot. I don't know if I know this culture. This seems different. And yet if I'm willing to see what's truly valuable and face the opposition that comes my way, I can know that God will be with me. I think that's powerful. And I think that's why the parents of Moses show up in Hebrews chapter 11, because of choices that they made. And so I have to figure out what kind of choices I want to make. Maybe you've seen the comparison, or you've heard it before, between a thermostat and a thermometer. One has some control over your environment. One has control over what the temperature is going to be. The other just reflects the temperature that's going on around it. If I want to know what the temperature is, I look at a thermometer. But if I want to change the temperature, I'll go to a thermostat. So when we look at our own lives, I think Moses' parents sort of prompt us to ask the question, who am I? Do I just reflect what's going on around me? Am I just kind of waiting to take my cue from other people? And if this is what they say is okay, and if this is what I'm told by culture is okay, that's just what I'm going to reflect? Or am I willing to see what's really valuable and face opposition? And I'm going to set the tone for how my life lives. And instead of allowing my life and my cultural values and my norms just to be determined by other people, to say, no, I want God to set the temperature of my life. I want Him to line me up exactly where I need to be. That's a question that all of us have to ask. It's a question that's made more powerful by seeing this life-changing birth that took place in Exodus chapter 2. As I've mentioned, there are a lot of connections between Moses' story and Jesus' story. But one key connection is that when we get to the New Testament, we also read about a life-changing birth from a ruler who's afraid of losing power. And we read about a leader who, like Moses, is misunderstood at times, but unlike Moses, lives a sinless life because he was not just a man. He's the Son of God. The question I have to ask myself is, what am I going to do about this life-changing birth? A birth that, because of what Jesus did, because of His life, His death, and resurrection, now allows me to have new birth. How am I going to react to the birth of Jesus that ultimately leads to my rebirth as a child of God? Scripture tells us that rebirth happens when I decide I'm going to turn my life over to God. I'm going to put Him on in baptism, and I'm going to continue to live day after day making that same choice to put Jesus first. If you need to be born again this morning, if you need a birth that will change your life, that's available. It may be that you need prayers of brothers and sisters in Christ. If you'd like to pray with a couple of our elders after this service, right out this doorway, we have a couple of our elders that would love to walk with you to the conference room, to have some time just to sit down and talk and pray and share. If there's any way we can help you, let's all be sure that we leave here knowing how to react to a birth that will change our lives if we let it. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand and as we sing together.